don't have the ability to put out the amp hours that the deep cells do. So that's my opinion.
Follow the E3JIW.
Very fine, Dennis. Jim, it sounds like you've got some more information for us. E3JIW, K2RIW. Go ahead, Jim.
I'll be quick. I was too quick. I'll come right back. VE3JIW. The emergency lighting is many that I've taken apart. This has been a few years, but less than, 10, okay. Their charger was a very low capacity unit with a Zener across a 6-volt battery. They just hold the battery at 6.8. Fire alarm systems have trickle and high rate charge, and they also actually put a small load on the battery every once in 5 minutes, some depending on the manufacturer, and confirm that the battery doesn't drop too quickly. At 26.5 on a pair of 12s, they resume charging. And they actually hit it with, some manufacturers hit it with quite a bit of voltage. When they hit 29.2 on a pair of 12s, they go back to trickle on it. So a fire alarm system oscillates, goes through those three stages all the time. Emergency lighting is just hold it at 6.8 for 6 volts, and a lot of the emergency lighting is just 6 volts, but there's a variety of systems used, and some of it is fire alarms have to recover the batteries in a period of hours, like so many hours or days. I mean, it's listed in hours. It may work out to a day and a half, but they have to be able to charge the batteries up in a reasonably quick period of time. It's one of the standards both in NEC and NFPA, if you're really curious.
Some more valuable information. Erica, when I send it back to you, Erica, give us the louder audio once again. When you give us the louder audio, you sound good. When you give us the soft audio, we have to turn up our volume control a little bit. About 2 months ago, on this technical net, on the subject of lead-acid batteries, we got into some pretty good discussions on the subject of the so-called battery minder technique. There's a whole brand name or style of chargers that are called battery minder, which not only put in a DC current, but a controlled amount of AC current is simultaneously superimposed on the charging of a lead-acid battery. And apparently has all kinds of very desirable restorative value in taking a sulfated lead-acid battery and bringing it back to life. From your experience, Eric, are any of the Cadillac brand of uninterruptible power supply systems that you buy for broadcast service, do you have reason to believe that some of these real Cadillac systems have battery minder function built into the charging system of the lead-acid-like batteries that are used on your high-class UPSs, KE2EJ, K2LAW in the TechNet? Okay, maybe Eric got called away. Anyone else with an answer on that one? Is the so-called battery minder function ever combined with the proper charging of the lead-acid batteries that are used on UPS systems? If I buy the right system, am I getting that simultaneously, or is that a completely separate item that I've got to buy? K2RIW listening for anybody with a comment.
NY2HF with a comment.
You've got it, Dennis.
All right, Dick, as far as what you're talking about, it's actually, that's a fourth step. With the three-step charger, you have bulk, absorption, and float. With the fourth step charger, you have equalization, and that's what does the desulfurization of the plates. That's a separate thing, and yes, you can get it. I have it on my trip light inverter, which is a 2400 watt pulse wave modified sine wave. And yes, but you don't get that in APDCs. I refuse to believe that you do. Most times you don't even get a pure sine wave. The fact of the matter.
Very fine, Dennis. More good information. So, Rich, look what you caused. I know we went quite a bit further than your particular gel cell battery that's in your LE Craft receiver, but still there's a lot of information about these kinds of lead-acid gel cell-like batteries. And by the way, Rich, there's a joke coming here. I should have asked you in the beginning, do you want the brief answer or do you want the verbose answer? N2EO, K2RIW, go ahead, Rich.
I got another comment, N2MB.
Stand by, Rich. Go ahead, Barry.
Yeah, I just want to mention, I use a lot of those in my business. I probably go through about 12 a month. And from my experience with them, they, after about 6 years, there's nothing you can do to save them. They should last. If you get good ones, they should last about 6 years. After that, my suggestion is to get rid of them. You can't, they don't charge properly anymore. Their voltage output drops. I mean, they're just not worth the trouble. I don't know how long Richie has had that battery, but if he's had it for 6 years, I recommend he just dumps it. And I can get most of those batteries from my distributor, so if anybody needs them wholesale, I'll be glad to help out. N2MB.
Okay, you didn't make it clear, but I'm going to make a guess. When you said get rid of them, I think you're talking about the lead acid slash gel cell battery system, get rid of them. And I have the impression that with some of the trickle charge operations of some of these UPSs, that beyond 2 years you wouldn't trust them. And if you've gotten as many as 6 years, I think you're very lucky. I think about the best I've ever gotten out of a car battery is something in the vicinity of 5.5 years. So you know of lead acid standby batteries, gel cell like systems that has last, that had a usable amount of ampere hours left at almost 6 years. Is that what you're saying, Barry? N2 Moonbounce, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yes, I'm saying that exactly. I don't know why, but the batteries that I'm using, and they've come from many different companies, they are good for 6 years. It's unusual, but I do have some fail earlier than 6 years, but most of them are good for 6 years, yeah. The usual failure mode that I find in those things after 6 years is they won't take a charge properly anymore. In other words, when you try to use them, they just drain down real quick. And the other thing is they start to leak, usually around the terminals on top. That's the first place you'll see the leakage. Yeah, but 6 years is about right. I would say, if you want to play it safe, 5 years, but you really should be good for 5 years, definitely.
And one other question I better ask you, Barry, since you use an awful lot of these lead-acid, gel cell-like batteries, do you have a favorite brand? Do you have a non-favorite brand? In other words, is there a brand A and B that you like, and there is a brand Z that you tell people to avoid? N2MB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, while you guys are talking, I'll run in the other room and grab one, because I never look at the brand name, but I will do that, and I'll come back with the brand name. Yes.
Okay, in the meantime, we'll go back to Rich. So, Rich, N2EO, did you want the verbose answer, or did you want the brief answer? N2EO, K2RIW for any fills. Go ahead, Rich.
Around here, and they're good.
Great, Rich. Bye-bye. You told us you like Ultratech. And it looks like some form of change has occurred in the system where we're getting feedback. I wonder if Eric is on board or K2YO or NY2H. Have any of the control people available? I wonder if you can make a change in the system. K2LI, are you listening?
Sounds like the outer limit is K2QI2.
I wonder is K2Yankee Oscar, NY2H, or KE2EJ available? K2LI could be in the tech net. Okay, I hope you can hear what's going on, Eric. KE2EJ, K2LIW. We're getting some kind of a half second feedback continuously. Over to you, Eric, K2LIW.
I'm aware
of it. I'm pretty sure I heard that, Eric, KE2EJ. Is that true, Eric, K2LIW? IW testing. Looks like we're back to normal operation. So, do you need any fills? Did you want the long answer or the short answer, Rich? N2EO, K2LIW. I think the system has been repaired. N2AO, EO, do you need any pills? And as a joke, did you want the verbose answer or did you want the brief answer? N2EO, K2LAW, go ahead, Rich.
Hey, Dick, well, I appreciate all the good information. I got a lot more than I thought I would get. And that's wonderful. What I am concerned about, Dick, is it likely or possible that that gel cell might have leaked? And if the leak is that stuff corrosive and does it stick? It's easy enough to take the cover off the K2. Problem is we just moved here. I gotta find my screwdrivers. They're in the toolbox. I have no idea where the toolbox is. And as you know, I had 21 hours of surgery recently on my spine. I don't want to send Patricia to look for the tools because she has her own issues. Go ahead, Vic.
Rich, I'm reasonably sure that if your gel cell is leaking any kind of a fluid, consider it a sulfuric acid, consider it toxic material, make sure it doesn't get on your clothing, make sure it doesn't get on your skin, and if the battery is leaking anything, consider the battery at end of life. Replace it. Don't try to restore a battery that's leaking. So if your gel cell or lead acid like sealed battery is leaking anything, do the best you can to remove it from the radio, because the acid coming out of it could do some damage to your printed circuit board and your integrated circuits. Remove it from the radio, discard it in a safe way. I mean, there's a whole procedure as to how we're supposed to dispose of a lead acid battery. You don't just put it into a garbage. You're allowed to bring it back to a store that sells lead acid batteries, even car batteries. So that's the right way to discharge get rid of them. So don't continue to use it if it's leaking anything there, Rich. N2EL, K2LIW.
Oh, I understand that, Dick. And, that's my worst fear with that radio, because I really spent a lot of time building it. It's like a factory job. Like I said, right now, recovering from my surgery, I had met a gentleman who lives right around here, and if he's listening, maybe he can get in touch with me, because he was in my house, and very nice gentleman. He met Patricia, and I met him. His name is Vito. His call is WA2PJS, and if he's listening, I'd like him maybe to come by here again and give me a hand, because I would like to check that out.
Yeah, we all know Vito very well. He has signed into the TechNet a whole lot of times, and he's our expert at Home Depot, who has talked. He has conscientiously taken many of the safety courses and other informational courses given by Home Depot, and he collects that information and gives it to us periodically. Okay, you know where you stand on that one. I'm going to take things out of order, because I know that Joe, KG2T, has to get up early. I've heard him very often early in the morning on the 449-125 repeater. So let me go out of order and pick up Joe before he has to leave us, because he gets up awful early. And let's take his question next. KG2T, hope you're still with us, Joe. K2LIW in the TechNet. I was a little bit afraid that Joe would have to leave us. Okay. The next person who signed in was Wes, N2XJN, who said he had a brief question that's different than his normal deep material at a later time. N2XJN, K2LIW. Go ahead, Wes.
Yeah, just a quick question for the Johnson guys. The Johnson, remember from the history? The transmitters and malfaxes and stuff. But they became pretty much commercial as well. I was on the Hampers, and I pick up among other things 18 by 9.5 inch air capacitor fixed for 30 pounds. And it says on a Johnson Company, Minnesota, USA. And there's a label on it which I couldn't find on the internet, but it's 1.6 big nanofarad, which was the label the guy put on it. I saw a label 1500 FBA/90. But my question is not how big it is. It's humongous. What I'm saying is, by which standard, historically, they've been labeling the capacitance of the capacitor as it strictly belongs from the frequency. And to it here.
Okay, 1.6 nanofarads is a fancy way of saying 1,600 microfarads. 1,600 microfarads is what that's really being said. That's a good size capacitor, but for the dimensions you've given me for a capacitor of 1600 microfarads, it sounds to me like it's a very high voltage capacitor.
John would describe you better. He saw it.
Go right ahead, John.
Wesley, are you discussing the air variable capacitor?
It was the huge stuff that you hold in your hands.
Are you talking about the air variable capacitor?
Somebody put a carrier on me. It's an air capacitor, but it wasn't variable. It wasn't variable. It was fixed.
I didn't see that one. The one I saw looked like a variable.
Yeah, but this one wasn't variable. It looks like a variable. It's fixed. It's not variable, but it's humongous. If you could describe to Dick how it looks like.
Okay, this is the one you paid $20 for, I believe. It looks like an air variable. It's about 14 inches long. It has many vanes on it. And I think it was rated for 7,000 volts. And I think it was 20 picofarad, Wes?
That was a 1600 picofarad that what a guy put on it, but the label says 1500, and it says 1500 PBA/90 on the label. It's a Johnson. It's a humongous. It's 18 inches by 9.5 inches, about 30 pounds. By which standards that they were putting on the label the capacitance, because it strictly belonged to the frequency range and to XGN.
I think I see what you're saying. And by the way, there are relatively simple procedures by which you could measure the number of picofarads, nanofarads. You could easily measure the number of microfarads or nanofarads of the capacitor. That's not too difficult. And yes, many of those circuits operate at 60 hertz. Some of them work at 1 kc. Some of them work at 1 megacycle. Usually a capacitor, an air variable capacitor, does not change microfarads, nanofarads, until you get to a significant length in wavelength. In other words, the physical dimension of that capacitor, 18 inches, let's call it a foot and a half long. And a foot and a half long is approaching a resonant frequency of around 500 megacycles. So if you were trying to measure the capacitance at 500 megacycles, you would literally be setting up a sine wave across the length of the capacitor, and you'd measure something very, very different. But I'm going to make a guess with the dimensions you've given me. Anything below, let's pick a number, 30 megahertz and lower, you're going to measure the exact same number of microfarads or nanofarads. So yes, physically large objects are somewhat frequency sensitive. But for the dimensions you've given me, as long as the outer dimension is a small fraction of a wavelength, a tenth or a twentieth of a wavelength, then the capacitance will be the same from there all the way down to the lowest frequencies where you can measure it. That's my guess, Wes. N2XJN, K2LIW in the TechNet. Megacycles. You would literally be setting up a sine.
Thank you very much for that explanation. In other words, the air capacitor, what you say, up to 500 megahertz, will probably keep the capacitor without a change, even though this one is 18 inches long and 9.5 inches wide. It's like a stack of plenty of plates. With quarter of inch spacing.
Plenty of space. With quarter of inch spacing. Plenty of space. With quarter of inch spacing. Plenty of space. With quarter of inch spacing.
approaching a significant portion of a wavelength, there will be no change in capacitance. There will be a change in capacitive reactance, because a capacitive reactance is 1 over 2 pi FC. But the capacitive reactance will change, and that's what exactly was supposed to happen. But from the dimensions you've given me, I would say I would trust that capacitor to keep its exact same capacitance up to at least 30 megahertz. By the time you get to 500 megahertz, the amount of capacitance will decrease, because you'll now be setting up a voltage variation across the length of the capacitor. The capacitor will start acting a little bit like a transmission line, if you know what I mean. But you're not going to be using it at 500 megs. I'd like to believe you're going to use it at 30 megahertz and lower, and at those frequencies, I think you're going to have no trouble with. Okay, one more call for Joe. Let's see if he's available. KG2T, I wonder if you're there, Joe. K2LIW in the TechNet. He's available. And I guess the answer, he might not be. We also had John, Whiskey Alpha 2, Victor David Hotel. I wonder if you're there, John. K2LIW in the TechNet.
To Victor David Hotel.
Yes, W-A-2-D-E-H. Oh, go ahead. Okay, John, I think you had a question, and we're ready for your question, John. W-A-2-D-E-H.
Did you have a question?
Hi, Dick. I didn't have a question. I just signed in to pass along the greetings from Richard Blauenhaus. That's all. I just passed along the greetings from Richard Blauenhaus. No questions, but thank you.
From Richard Blauenhaus. That's all. I just passed along the greetings.
Very fine, John. From
on the New England Reflector. Link clear.
Yeah, from my notes, I should have realized that, John, and I thank you for that. Now, I think it's time we go over to the mail. John, KC2WGB, K2LIW in the second end. Go right ahead, John.
Am I coming through that, Dick?
They're coming through fine, John. Go right ahead.
Repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England Reflector.
Link active.
If I was operating a six. KE2EJ, KQLAW, you'll notice that whenever the link is active, we're getting a feedback characteristic. Maybe there's a way of adjusting that. KE2EJ, if you're available, KQLAW.
Probably playing a feedback on what you are doing. Disconnect the nose with the reflector, you won't have that problem anymore.
Unfortunately, if you disconnect that node, an awful lot of the people out in the hinterland can no longer hear what we're saying. So we're between a rock and a hard place, as I see it, Joe. KE2EJ, KQRIW, I wonder if you've got a suggestion, Eric. Near infrared laser at roughly 1 micron, 1,000 nanometers, and I could transmit another 10 gigahertz there, and I could combine it with a third laser in far infrared, where again I transmit another 10 gigahertz of bandwidth. So some of these fibers, when they're well designed, will tolerate far infrared, near infrared, low optical, high optical, ultraviolet. Some of these fiber optics, fibers, will tolerate many different optical frequency regions, and each optical frequency region can tolerate up.
Repeater, timeout.
Each one of those optical regions can tolerate numbers like 10 gigahertz, 10 gigabits per second of data with good designs and procedures. So the magic of fiber is higher frequency of the central frequency of the carrier, and once you're at higher frequency, the same percentage of bandwidth represents a huge bandwidth at which you can transmit a data rate, and the fiber has numbers like a fraction of a decibel per kilometer of insertion loss. No coaxial cable can come within a mile of that kind of performance. So, as you can see, it's a win-win-win situation when you go to fiber. And the whole world is going to be connected with fiber very soon, if it's not already. And coaxial cable, except for the run between your transmitter and your antenna, and the same thing with the broadcast transmitter that's doing over-the-air broadcast, that's about the only places where coaxial cable and twisted pair is going to be used in the future. Let me drop. Which is one hell of a difference from what happened in roughly 1948. I remember in 1948, on Channel 4, Howdy Doody, the Howdy Doody program, this puppet that became very popular, was bragging about the fact that they were going to establish a coaxial cable across the United States, so that the people in California could watch the programs and the people in Chicago could watch the programs like Howdy Doody, which was being produced in New York City. The coaxial cable was going to do that. Well, that was the best technology of 1948, and a whole lot of intermediate amplifiers were required because that was really a cable TV system, if you know what I mean. That got replaced with these microwave links that Bob Bell set up a few years later, and that eventually got replaced with fiber. The whole darn nation is now filled up with fiber as the major method of transmitting long signals across the United States, across the Atlantic Ocean, across the Pacific Ocean, across the Asian Ocean, and so on. So fiber is here to stay, and boy, does it have capability, and you ain't seen nothing yet. That's a little bit of the story here, John, as I see it. KC2 WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Come with us.
Okay, I'm hearing Dennis and Wes in that order. Dennis first. NY2HF, K2LIW. Go ahead, Dennis.
K2HF.
I'm also hearing Dennis first. Go ahead.
On Long Island, and they're going to go to fiber optics all throughout. So just trying to support what you're saying. Copper is on the way out. It's an expensive commodity, and they're going to go with fiber optics back to that.
Very fine, Dennis. Dennis, you sound good, but you could use a little bit more audio. And now we've got Wes and Eric in that order. Wes, go ahead with your comments on fiber.
Yeah, you are mentioning the spectrum that's suitable for fiber, and I've heard you mention ultraviolet, which I have a problem with it, because actually ultraviolet is that which should be the most avoided in fibers. Enter here.
Now, when I said ultraviolet, I was speculating. I know that fibers will definitely properly convey near-infrared, sometimes far-infrared, and very frequently optical frequencies. Whether or not that it will also convey ultraviolet frequencies, which inside of the fiber would be safe if they would do it. I'm just not sure whether or not the fiber will tolerate ultraviolet with its insertion loss characteristics. Eric has used a lot of fiber in his time. Guarantee he's got a lot more information than my speculation. So fill us in on fiber and its bandwidth and its desired center frequencies, Eric. KE2EJ, K2LIW in the tech net.
Sorry, Jim, I
that's good. I'm in the middle of working on stuff.
What was the question about fiber?
Yeah, for the violet.
Yeah, I had speculated that when it comes to the instantaneous bandwidth of data that you can transmit in fiber, I'm saying that some of the fibers will transmit OC192, 10 gigabits per second of near-infrared, far-infrared, and optical. In other words, I could have three separate frequency regions simultaneously being sent with dichroic mirrors and whatever through a piece of fiber. I was also speculating whether or not some of the modern fibers could also convey ultraviolet. And maybe the fiber doesn't have enough transparency in ultraviolet. And so you might have some knowledge on that. KE2EJ, K2LIW in the TechNet. K2LIW,
K2EJ. Yeah, you're going to find the audio a little bit low right now. I'm working on that. Actually, the WDM, you can put a whole bunch of stuff, different colors, different wavelengths. We haven't quite made it past the blues yet, simply because of attenuation in the glass is one problem. The other problem is creating the light source, that's another problem, and the photo detector, that's another problem. They're not insurmountable problems. You're going to see much shorter wavelengths in the near future, but you can get 10 gigabits on a single wavelength and pack them together. There are some national cables that run, there's a company called Williams, which is the big pipeline company. They have sites and they're called Vivix, which they transport data from one end of the country to the other. And they can pack something like 200 or 300 gigabits all at the same time, very easily. K2RWP, do you think?
So what you're confirming, so because of the lack of good ultraviolet sources and good ultraviolet detectors, probably very little use has been made of ultraviolet so far. But I'm getting the impression that optical frequencies, near-infrared, and relatively far-infrared are three of the frequency regions being used at quite frequently 10 gigabits per region. In other words, OC192 standard. Is that approximately true, Eric? KE2EJ? And by the way, your audio sounds good. K2LIW?
YW, you'll notice there's no delay at the moment. Now, you know, as they say, technology marches on. And that's exactly what's happening. So, give us some time. You'll see greater bandwidth. Now, actually, we run through New York State. We start out by running a gigabit, a gig E, between Buffalo and Long Island. Now it's 10 gig E, and that's just a single WDM. And it's packed with, it's actually transported with a whole lot of other stuff that we don't actually have access to, but it's getting more and more interesting all the time.
Coming on ultraviolet.
Now you've used the word WDM a few times. Sounds like Whiskey Delta Mike. Want to tell us what that stands for, Eric? Go ahead.
Wave Division Multiplex. And you can think of it as Frequency Division Multiplex, if you want to think of it in radio terms.
So my guess is by way of dichroic mirrors, you separate it into a low, medium, and high wavelength region, and each of those could be numbers as much as 10 gigabits per second by the OC192 standard of the right kind of source, detector, and modulator. Is that approximately true, Eric? KE2EJ, K2LIW?
Well, believe it or not, Dick, if you look at, in your house, you probably have some Cisco switches. You may find a little square hole that you wonder what it is. It doesn't look like an Ethernet connection, but it looks like a little rectangular hole. And actually, in that goes a multimode, little silver thing, which has the emitter and photo detector for connecting to fiber. And those little silver things, which is small, come come in different wavelengths. They come at 1610, 1620, 1635, 1600, 1590. There's a whole selection of them, and they're all operating on different frequencies, and we actually don't need to use dive quads. The emitters in them are, in essence, attuned to those frequencies, but they do have a filter that is at the appropriate frequency.
Fantastic. And each one of those frequency regions, I think you're saying, started off at 1 gig, but many of them are now up to 10 gigs per individual frequency region, 10 gigabits per second. Is that approximately true, Eric? Go ahead.
Yeah, it is. And by the way, OC-192 is kind of old hat at this point. It's the OC-512 and getting higher. So, you know, it used to be standard. OC-256 was like the top end, but it didn't exceed it.
I thought I remembered at OC-384 was 40 gigahertz bits per second, OC-384. And you're saying that's being exceeded by OC-512? Wow. How many gigabits per second is that standard, Eric? Go ahead.
I can't remember, but I think it's 120. Don't quote me on it.
Lots and lots of bandwidth. So as you can see, John, fiber is here to stay. And it's going to be a long time before we find a better medium for transmitting thousands of miles with small numbers of dB of loss and with higher data rates. Fiber is it. KC2WTB, K2LAW, go ahead, John.
Just let me remind you that not only is a single fiber capable of handling 100 gigabits worth of data, but in most cases, a fiber comes in bundles, where it would be six in a G or 24 or 100, depending upon where you're going. Sometimes it's just redundant, sometimes you need the bandwidth.
Not only is Eric making lots of use of fiber in his broadcast industry, you listen in the morning to the UHF frequency, one of them is a 449-125, at around 6 in the morning, you'll be hearing Rich N2PPN on his way to work, and he's the guy who travels into New York City each day in order to install more and more of those fibers between the buildings, between the uptown and downtown and whatever. He's installing and testing those fibers. So some of us ham radio operators are heavily involved in the super bandwidth and the testing of those systems and the installation of those systems. Over to you, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick. I think Wesley had a question. I heard him come in there.
Go ahead. Say that ultraviolet caused degradation. See, the structure that was usually the carbon fiber during phosphate. Actually, the ultraviolet was the least expected factor here. Created a lot of grief. So, till now, at least I have no knowledge of anyone or the fiber optics that is suitable of carrying on ultraviolet.
According to Eric, the only reason ultraviolet is not being used right now is because there's a lack of high-efficiency emitters and a lack of high-efficiency detectors for the ultraviolet. But I'm led to believe that the fiber itself is capable of conveying it. And although ultraviolet is a damaging wavelength when it comes to interaction with biological materials, I don't think it is a damaging wavelength when it comes to interacting with fiber optic glass. So you have to be careful that the human being is not exposed to it, but I don't think it's damaging to the glass. That's a bunch of opinions. We'll eventually find more about that as time goes on. Over to you, John. KC2WGB, K2LAW.
That's true.
I think broadcasting at this time. So go on with the next question, John. That was a good one. KC2WGB, K2LIW.
Okay, Dick. No problem. All right. Have a young ham here who has heard many of our discussions on directional couplers, and he acquired one recently. What he wants to do with it is put it in series with his antenna line and use the sample port, and he wants to put a diode on there so he can connect it up to the DCN or whatever meter he's going to use, and actually mark it with a comparison to a bird. He wants to know if that will work, what kind of diode he needs, maybe I have a number for him, and what do you think of that, and it would be a safe thing to do. Back to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
Properly done, that's an extremely safe thing to do. Properly done, it is a very interesting thing to do. I can give you data that is traceable to the Bureau as far as power output is concerned. It could be a poor man's bird watt meter, so to speak. The first thing you got to worry about, though, is what is the amount of coupling of your directional coupler. If, for instance, and this is a very rare item, if, for instance, you had picked up a 40 decibel directional coupler, let me show you what that would be. It definitely exists, but it's a very rare item. It would be extremely desirable for this location because let's assume now that I'm running a 100 watt transmitter, a typical number for ham radio. 100 watts, if you convert it into the units of dBm, which is the world that I live in, 1 watt is plus 30, 10 watts is plus 40, 100 watts is plus 50. Plus 50 dBm is the power of a 100 watt transmitter. If it was a 40 decibel coupler, that really means minus 40 dB. So the signal flowing down the main line of the directional coupler is plus 50 dBm. dB with reference to a milliwatt in my example. And because the coupler is minus 40 dB, that means that the amount of signal coming out of the directional port would be 40 dB weaker than the plus 50, it would be plus 10 dBm. Plus 10 dBm is what comes out. Plus 10 dBm is 10 milliwatts. Almost every diode that you can put your hands on will not be damaged by 10 milliwatts. Almost every diode you can put your hands on that operates at that frequency region will give you a very nice transfer curve at plus 10 milliwatts. At plus 10 milliwatts, I'm not sure of the exact number, but after the diode detector, you're going to have something like
repeater, timeout.
After that diode detector, you would have something in the vicinity of half a volt or 1 volt of signal going into your digital voltmeter. And that would be a very convenient number, which then you could easily calibrate that by running your transmitter at 100 watts, then 50 watts, then 10 watts, and looking at how many volts comes out. It would be a beautiful way of confirming that your transmitter is working correctly. If your transmitter is any kind of an amplitude modulated transmitter, like single sideband or AM, you could take the output of the diode detector, put it into an oscilloscope, and look at the real envelope waveform of what you're transmitting. It'd be a fun thing to do. That's what would happen with a 100 watt transmitter and a 40 decibel directional coupler. Now let's get into the real world, because that's a rather rare item. A more typical directional coupler is in the vicinity of 10, 15, or 20 decibels of coupling. That's the more typical one. As such, let me drop. As such, a plus 50 dBm signal attenuated by a minus 10 dB directional coupler would give you a plus 40 dBm signal into the diode. Plus 40 dBm is 10 watts. You put 10 watts into any kind of a diode detector, and most likely you're going to damage it. Now, there are solutions to that. You can create all kinds of additional attenuators that you apply to the directional port of the directional coupler to bring that signal down to a more reasonable level, plus 10 dBm, which is 10 milliwatts. So In my example, if you use that 10 dB directional coupler followed by a 30 decibel attenuator and then the diode detector, then the power level would be very appropriate. There's another solution. Let me drop. And that is to intentionally buy a directional coupler for the wrong frequency region. This is the exact thing that I had to do. And if you take a look at, let me think now, the article that was published by me in the February 1970 issue of QST, no, Ham Radio Magazine, February 1970, Ham Radio Magazine, which is in the archives, to my knowledge, of ARRL. If you go to the ARRL archives, and I think they do have the past issues of Ham Radio Magazine, if you take a look at the article by K2RIW called the 144-432 Strip Line Amplifier Tripler, that was the name of the article, but in there, I described how to use a directional coupler in the wrong frequency region. If you chose a 10 dB coupler that's made for the 10 gigahertz region, which is exactly what I did, even though it's designed for 10 gigahertz, as you go to lower frequency than is designed, it falls off in performance, falls off in coupling coefficient in a very predictable manner. It falls off at exactly 6 dB per octave. So as you go down to, if it's designed for 10 gigahertz and you use it at 5 gigahertz, a 10 dB coupler becomes a 16 dB coupler. If you use it at 250 megahertz, it becomes 6, 12, it becomes a 22 dB coupler, and so on. By the time you get down to the frequencies you're likely to use, your 10 dB coupler, designed for 10 gigahertz, is going to be a 40 or a 50 dB coupler. That's exactly what I did in order to test this 300-watt transmitter. So, once you understand the theory of operation of a transmitter,
repeater, time out.
Once you understand the theory of operation of a directional coupler, and that article will give you a hint that the February 1970 Ham Radio Magazine article will give you a hint about how to do it, because I went through the real mathematics, so to speak. And there's one other place. There was an article that I published on directional couplers. Yeah, the even better article is the one that was in the North Texas Microwave Society, what's it called now? Roadrunner's K5RMG. If you go to the K5RMG Roadrunner's Microwave group and you go to their technical article that used to be on their website, and for reasons I don't understand, they removed those articles from the website. However, by way of the Wayback file, if you go back to the records for the K5RMG group, K5 Roadrunner's Microwave group, you go to the Wayback file, and you go to what used to be on their website in their so-called technical article section, you will find a 1,500-word article. You'll find a 1,500-word article by K2RIW on how to properly use directional couplers outside of their frequency region with all the mathematics that goes with it. So I think I've mailed a copy of that article to you, Eric. Here we go, John. I mailed you a copy of that article. Therefore, you have the ability to send the article directly to this particular guy. But now you know where to get a hold of it.
One, two.
And all the mathematics as to how to use directional couplers outside of the frequency region, how to get the power level down to the level where your crystal diode detector will not be damaged. And by the way, selecting the right diode for the detector is easy as all hell. A 1N34 diode would do it. There's a whole bunch of Schottky diodes. In other words, it would be difficult for you to find a diode that's not going to do the function, if you know what I mean. So selecting the diode is a minor function.